Well, today is Mother's Day. It is not necessarily characteristic as a general rule for me to emphasize what we call non-Christian holidays within the course of the year. I used to be much more consistent in these things, but have found less enthusiasm to regularly stop what we're doing when there's not necessarily a direct need to do so to acknowledge a holiday, and particularly those holidays, as I said, that are not directly Christian in origin. But this year, I believe there is a need to pause and not so much teach on motherhood per se, as much as give a tribute to motherhood, as you see here. This is going to be a little bit of a different message, perhaps not as weighty, as heavy, as directed, as academic, perhaps, as some of my other ones. It might be a little bit of a rest of sorts as I speak to these things. If you want to get back into the academic, of course, there's always a message this evening in Hebrews. We live in a culture now where motherhood is much maligned, where women are in fact actively discouraged oftentimes from motherhood, are taught that motherhood is a general inconvenience that is serving to inhibit women's ambitions. And this has led to a number of manifestations as it relates to society. It's led to a feministic fervor for insisting that women are not only equal to men in dignity, of which none of us would argue that women are equal to men in dignity, that there is the image of God in every man and in every woman, and that there is a co-dignity between them, but rather that women are the same as men, which of course is biblically, biologically, and practically absurd. It's also led to a general culture of death, whereby women are not just freed, but in fact actively encouraged to put their children to death in the name of the God of self. Sexual pleasure, convenience, and ambition. Now we know that the source of these manifestations is a humanistic idea, and to the extent that it is humanism, it is rooted in the promises of Satan in the Garden of Eden, and so can in truth be called satanic. But an important checkpoint along the path of these ambitions, whether it be the feministic ambitions or the culture of death, has been to marginalize the role of mothers in society. And this should not be missed. The correlation between these elements, the breakdown of societal norms, structure, and morality, and the attack upon the institution of motherhood. It does not just place motherhood as another path for women, these attacks, but it degrades motherhood generally into an inferior path for women, which is presented as being at most experienced as an adjunct to a career, at worst or more likely taught as something which women should defer entirely as a direct competition with life as it ought to be lived. But the Bible teaches us very differently. As we look into the scriptures, the Bible elevates motherhood really to one of its highest honors. And it is this that I would like to contemplate today in a manner of a tribute of sorts. This message is not to diminish the calling of lives, and let me be clear about this. This is not to diminish the calling of others, lives of certain women, not to be mothers. God has not called all women to be wives. He has not called all men to be husbands. He has not called all wives to be mothers, and he has not called all husbands to be fathers. And we know this to be true, but in the same way that the scripture calls upon the church to honor the elders that are among them, even though not every man will be called to be an elder, and in the same way that the church or that the scriptures call us to honor kings and governors, though not every man will be elevated to the position of kings and governors, so too we identify an honor that is given to mothers, even though not all women will be called unto such a position. And so today we contemplate the biblical honor bestowed upon those women, not simply who bear children per se, but specifically those who align themselves with the commission of God upon their lives to bear children and love them, nurture them, and train them. in the way of God. And we begin with a particular thought in the context of what Proverbs 31 calls the virtuous woman. The intent of this passage, Proverbs 31, is actually not to extol the virtues of motherhood per se, but rather to extol the virtues of biblical womanhood. That the virtuous woman is a woman of integrity. She's a woman of initiative. She's a woman of work ethic. She's a woman of selflessness. She labors consistently and constantly for the success of her husband and of her household. And we find that she is a woman of tremendous industry, that she is not someone who is just sitting at home by any stretch of the imagination, but she is very busy. She is very active. She is working in really a business-type way under her husband for the advancement of her household and for the advancement of his ambitions, really. And not much is said about this virtuous woman in the context itself about motherhood, but that does not mean it's not there. Much to the contrary, in Proverbs 31, verse 28, we find this. As it describes this woman, Proverbs 31, verse 28 says, "Her children arise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praiseth her." The virtuous woman's qualities are there for all to see. She is blessed of her children. She is praised of her husband, because she is the hinge upon which the household swings. It's been said that behind the success of every great man has been a good woman. The implication of that statement is that for many men, they would not have been able to see their vision through, their ambitions come to fruition in the way they would desire without being able to have the support of a loving wife. Now, both in the sense of emotional encouragement and motivation, that's the idea of that saying. And in the Proverbs 31 sense of a woman and her management and her industry contributing to his overall success, we see a measure of truth. And though this idea is often true, it's certainly not an axiom, right? It's not an axiomatic statement. Many great men, even as far as the Bible is concerned, have operated without necessarily being married and having a woman at their side. We think of Elijah, we think of Daniel, we think of Paul, we think of Jesus himself, unmarried men. So while it's not axiomatic to say that every great man has been bolstered by a good wife, it can without question be said that every great man who ever lived has derived his life and essence from his mother. Formed and nurtured in her womb, deriving truly his life from hers. And we find in Scripture this phrase, born of a woman, to be synonymous with the idea of being human, in fact. It's used by Jesus of John the Baptist when he declared in Matthew 11, verse 11, "Verily I say unto you, among them that are born of women, there hath not risen a greater than John the Baptist, notwithstanding he that is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he." Jesus describes the idea of John the Baptist being the greatest of men by saying that there is no man born of woman who has risen greater than him. So we see this concept of being born of woman as synonymous with, in fact, humanity. The same sentiment is used of Jesus in Galatians 4:4, which says, "When the fullness of time was come, God sent forth his Son, made of a woman, made under the law." Jesus is said to be made of a woman in that he was, as every other man and woman who has ever lived, was formed in his mother's womb, with, of course, the exception of Adam as the direct creation of God. No human man has ever existed other than Adam, apart from the intrinsic life-bearing contribution of a mother. And this life-bearing process, not just in the womb, but in those early years of life, as she cares for the child, as she weans the child, has never been one that should be taken for granted. Ever since the beginning of civilization, Satan has desired the lives of the young. And as you go through the scriptures and as you look through history, Satan has always desired the lives of the young. Be that in the days of Israel's infancy, when Pharaoh sought to curb the birth rate of those in Israel by killing the children that were born, and Moses' mother took him and hid him and then put him in that basket and sent him down the river as a means by which to spare his life from the inevitable death of Pharaoh's decree? Or be that Satan's desire to destroy children through the heritage of the sacrifices made unto Molech in the Old Testament days, where these pagan religions, and then as it crept into Israel's society, would demand the lives of children to be put on the altar and killed in the name of some promised blessing. Or, of course, be that the culture of death that we see today, a similar humanistic, false God-inspired sacrifice of children on the altar of convenience through the process of abortion. The first tribute to our mothers throughout history is that mothers yielded their bodies and their lives in order to care and to sustain our lives. That every person in here who is living today is here because you had a mother who bore you, birthed you, and cared for you. And that's the first tribute of our mothers, giving themselves to see us into this world and to establish our well-being at the expense of themselves. And yet this great sacrifice is only the beginning of their investment. Particularly among godly mothers, it is only the beginning of their investment. In Titus 2, verses 1 through 8, we receive a manifesto, in a sense, of the elder men and the elder women and young men and their duties as it relates to being born-again believers, Christians in the church, how they function one with another. And as it relates to the young women, Titus 2, verse 4 speaks of the elder women teaching the young women, and it says this, that they may teach the young women to be sober, to love their husbands, to love their children. As we consider further revelation, we find the call upon the wife and mother is to love her husband and to love her children. The life of sacrifice of a godly mother does not end when the child is weaned and is generally sufficient, in a sense, to live on its own. But instead it transitions solely from the nurture of a young body to the nurture of a young body and a young soul. And who can measure the impact of a mother? And let me say it this way. There are people here that did not grow up with godly mothers. Maybe some in here, and I've interacted with many in the jail, who grew up with unkind mothers, abusive mothers. Confused mothers, mothers with so many of their own problems, neglectful mothers. And yet, as we look at the legacy of motherhood, for good or for ill, who can measure the legacy, the impact of motherhood upon the life of a child? The influence of mothers, even biblically speaking, we can see this. We just see the shadows of it biblically. Jacob's mother. Moses' mother, as we talked about already. Ruth, who was impacted not by her mother directly in the scriptures, but by her mother-in-law and the guidance of her mother-in-law. Solomon's mother. Lemuel's mother. The impact as seen in scriptures, however, serves only to reflect what life and experience makes very clear to all of us. The influence of mothers upon their children, for good or for ill, is irrefutable. And it runs deep in all of our lives. Our mothers are our first teachers. And to this end, the impact of a mother upon her children is almost impossible to quantify. To this end, mothers, it is for you to know and to know well the tremendous importance that your role carries in the family, in the church, and in all of society. I've often said that children will relate themselves to God as their father through the example that earthly fathers set in the home. We'll talk about this more on Father's Day. But it is true that when a child is attempting, particularly actually in their teenage years, to relate themselves to the nature of God, and they read about God as their father, they relate that to the nature of how their father has interacted with them. So that I've told you before, fathers, that you are setting an example, you are setting a precedent for helping or hindering your children's capacity to understand the nature of their relationship with God through the nature of their relationship with you. And this is very, very much true. But in the days of Adam, God commissioned the first man to name all of the animals. And as Adam named all of the animals, it was apparent at the end of that process that there was found no companion for him. So the Bible says that God put Adam to sleep and he took one of his ribs, and out of that rib he formed woman. Adam saying, "This is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh," uniting them together and declaring that those two would be made one flesh. And we find in this account an intrinsic reality that women, as with men, bear the image of God, and in that men and women are different, we must understand that each gender bears different characteristics of God to a unique degree. So while children do indeed relate themselves to God the Father through their own fathers in that example, at least until they're able to differentiate between them in a more sophisticated way, it can be rightly said as well that the first true understanding a child will generally receive of the character and nature of God will be through the character and qualities of their mothers. Mothers, you have been given this as a great honor, not only to give your life to nurture a child, but also to imprint upon their souls an understanding of God's love, of God's care, and of God's nurture. When Jesus said, "Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends," though he in his crucifixion would no doubt bear the greatest example of that sacrificial love, and we know that to be true, really the first display of that kind of sacrificial love that God has designed for us to see and to understand, though not all will experience it, and we know that to be true, but the first display of that sacrificial love is found in our mothers. The first essential lessons in selflessness and of yielding one's life for the sake of another. As with everything in life, sacrifice is not easy, particularly the consistent sacrifice that is needed to guide a child into adulthood. Such a sacrifice demands courage, demands fortitude, demands integrity, tying us back to that Proverbs 31 idea of the virtuous woman, that woman of integrity and initiative and courage and strength. And in this, we find the value of a virtuous woman. And if, as Proverbs 31 says, the price of a virtuous woman, her life is priceless, beyond rubies, how much more, or to what extent, do we find that same virtue in a godly mother? And mothers, it is this that I carry unto you in particular as an exhortation on this morning of Mother's Day. We've spoken before about 1 Timothy 2. Toward the end of the chapter in 1 Timothy 2, Paul gives an exhortation for women of the church to exemplify this virtue. He says in 1 Timothy 2, verses 9 and 10, "In like manner also, that women adorn themselves in modest apparel with shamefacedness and sobriety, not with broidered hair or gold or pearls or costly array, but which becometh women professing godliness with good works." Giving you this as a means of context. The adornment of a virtuous woman, according to Scripture, is not the adornment of externalities, of adornments which draw attention to her physical beauty, her wealth, her capacities. Rather, the adornments of a virtuous woman are the adornments that allow the content of her character to be the defining features of her life and of her interactions. It is the content of her character. It is that virtue that is intended to bubble up. And the call is that a woman would not obscure the content of her character through other externalities that would seek to distract or confuse or misalign themselves with that content of her character. The virtuous woman is not by nature a woman who is direct in her efforts to make herself unattractive, but rather that she adorns herself in a manner that allows her character to shine through. The woman who has directed her efforts towards those things which truly matter, namely those things which become a woman professing godliness. Paul then extends this exhortation to the nature of teaching in the assembly, and he says in verses 11 through 14, "Let the women learn in silence with all subjection. But I suffer not a woman to teach, nor to usurp authority over the man, but to be in silence. For Adam was first formed, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived was in the transgression." He exhorts women then to maintain a proper headship structure in the assembly. And that's what this is. This is about design. This is not about a woman's capability. We've already talked about the fact that a woman is by no means in any way inferior or superior in dignity to a man, but rather that God has a design in place. And as you think about this, it is not just that way between man and woman. It is actually that way even in the Godhead, is it not? That Jesus Christ, though not inferior in any way in dignity, so that Philippians 2 says that Christ, though co-equal with God, thinking it not robbery to be equal with God, yet he humbled himself, right? And made himself of no reputation. Jesus submitted himself to the Father, though they are co-equal in dignity, because of headship, because of structure and design. In the same way, there is a headship structure as it relates to men and women. Has nothing to do with their dignity. It has nothing to do with their worth. It has nothing to do with their capabilities. It has everything to do with design. And as such, there is a structure in the assembly that women are not teachers, that women do not usurp authority over men, but rather they are in subjection or submission, to be in silence. Now, the purpose of my time today, of course, is not to exposit this passage, nor to define the concept of women's subjection in the assembly. I've preached on that many times, and the nature of what that is and what that isn't. And of course, again, we're not saying that women are inferior or anything of the sort, and those of you that know me know that. Except to say that the nature of this exhortation is not even that women cannot speak in the assembly, but rather that they are to have no authoritative representation in the assembly, either as a teacher or one who authoritatively questions the teachers. And Paul, in stating this and in calling the church unto this, he appeals to the fall of man, where Adam was first formed, reflecting his headship over women, and then over the woman, and then Eve. And so Adam was formed, then Eve, Adam being the first formed, Adam being given that role and that position of headship. And then Eve, Paul says, was the one who was deceived of the serpent, reflecting the consequences of the fact that Adam yielded his headship to his wife. He yielded the authority that he was responsible to claim and to take to his wife, whether because of his own laziness or whether because of his own selfishness or whether because of his own ambition. He yielded his headship, he yielded his responsibility to his wife, and in doing so, it brought about the means through which this fall took place. Not blaming the woman for the fall. In fact, we know from Scripture, as Paul says here, the woman was deceived. Doesn't say the man was deceived. The man was not deceived. Adam knew what he was doing. He yielded his headship. He wanted this rebellion. He wanted to be as God. And so indeed, as Romans chapter 5 says, as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin. Eve did not bring sin into the world. Adam brought sin into the world. And so we don't confuse that. But what we do see is that Adam yielded his headship to the women, to the woman's judgment and to her authority. And what Paul is warning is that the church not do the same. That the church not yield its headship role, the headship role of the men in the assembly, to the women. Now, I've given you all of this context in order that we might come to the final verse of chapter 15, which says this: "Notwithstanding she," that would be the woman, shall be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith and charity and holiness with sobriety. Paul speaks to a redeeming quality for women as it relates to their role in the assembly, in that they have no authority to teach. They have no authority to contribute in an authoritative way in the assembly. Say, well, Pastor, where does that leave us? If they cannot teach, if they cannot get up and if you as women cannot get up and teach and have that kind of impact in the assembly, what is then that your role and what consolation do you have? And Paul speaks here of a great consolation to women who he calls to be mothers, that they are saved in childbearing. Now, this is not being born again. When we see the word saved in scriptures, I think we've covered this probably three or four times over the past month or two because it keeps coming up. When the Bible uses the word saved, it's not always speaking of being born again. It's not always speaking of the idea of being justified by faith. Throughout the scope of the New Testament, the word saved can mean healed from illness. It can mean being delivered from the consequences of sinful choices. It can mean being brought out of poverty. And in this case, it speaks of the idea of the value and the purpose of women in the assembly being redeemed and justified by a most essential contribution. Don't miss this. That as mothers, as they teach and nurture their children, and as those children grow and continue in the faith, in charity, that word meaning love, right? Not just giving gifts, but the idea of biblical love and holiness with sobriety, the responsibility of mothers to do this brings about a reward. And the reward, the consolation, the salvation of mothers in the assembly is that, mothers, you are raising up the next generation of the church. John the Baptist was called by Jesus the greatest man to be born of women. What must this say about the character of the woman who raised him and birthed him and nurtured him? David was said to be a man after God's own heart. What does this say about the mother who raised him? Paul speaks explicitly of the legacy of godly women in the life of his spiritual son Timothy, does he not? 2 Timothy chapter 1, verses 3 through 5. Paul says, I thank God, whom I served my forefathers with pure conscience, that without ceasing I have remembrance of thee in my prayers night and day, greatly desiring to see thee, being mindful of thy tears, that I may be filled with joy, when I call to remembrance the unfeigned faith that is in thee, which dwelt first in thy grandmother Lois and thy mother Eunice, and I am persuaded that in thee also. So Paul reflects upon the faith of Timothy here, his beloved disciple and friend. And he traces the lineage of that faith through two godly mothers, his grandmother Lois and his mother Eunice. And this, mothers, is that salvation of which Paul speaks. A long-term purpose, a purpose which demands faith and consistency of character over the course of decades as you represent the Lord to your children. This is why we began with that idea of the virtuous woman, that woman who works and labors tirelessly for the good of her household, for the wellness, so that her children will arise and call her blessed. Why? Because she has been a faithful, consistent reflection of that which is right, a consistent reflection of integrity and of work ethic and of truth and of virtue. A purpose that does not afford you days off from the requirements which will be asked of you, but a purpose which is not just essential to the life of those dear children of yours. And mothers, you think about that and you are driven and you are motivated by the fact that there are these young lives who are dependent upon you and who look to you and who love you and who you love and who you care for and who you nurture. And that's all well and good, but don't forget, your faithfulness is essential not just to the future of your children. Your faithfulness is essential to the future of this church. Your faithfulness is essential to the future of our society. So that when we say that you are raising the next generation, That means you bear the privilege of having your fingerprints upon the future of this church, the future of this society in a very real way. And what this means, mothers, is that we are dependent upon you. And this is that redemption. This is that salvation. This is the essence of your function in the body. Without you, we might be able to live our lives in a measure of spiritual success. But without you, the future is very bleak. Because your children, our future. Mothers, you have looked on with sorrow, with frustration, and perhaps with horror at the events of society as they have unfolded over the course of the last decade. You have seen these things, and fathers and mothers alike look and say, what is the future for our children? You wonder what, if anything, you might be able to do. And we talk about the various things, you know, in a societal standpoint. We look at where things are right now and the trouble that society is having, and we say, well, we've got to get busy. We've got to get active. We've got to become activists. We've got to get on school boards, and we need to call our local representatives, and we need to make our voice heard. And you see that, and you see oftentimes that mothers step up, and they take these positions, and they do these things, and that's all well and good. But the absolute best and most essential way, mothers, you can make a lasting change in society for the better is to be a godly and virtuous and faithful mother. It's to raise up your children unto that next generation. What our society needs right now is not more people in the pool of societal laborers. What our society needs right now is not more fashion models or female influencers. What our society needs right now more than anything else is a generation of young people raised by godly and virtuous mothers to be sent out to influence the world. Galatians chapter 6, verse 9 says this, "Let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we faint not. They shall be saved in childbearing. She shall be saved in childbearing if they continue," the scriptures tell us, "in faith and in charity and in holiness with sobriety." Mothers, you have an essential role in this assembly, and it won't be getting up here and expositing the scriptures, and it won't be teaching a Sunday school class before the body, and it won't be those things. But you have an essential role in that your children will step out into this world, will be the next generation of the church, will become the next pastors, will become the wives and the mothers of the next generation, will raise them up in a godly way. And on the day that Paul wrote these words in Galatians 6, he was not speaking to mothers about their responsibility in the home. In fact, he was speaking to the church about their responsibilities as it relates to the assembly. But on this day, this is my plea to mothers. You are the backbone of society, and you are the backbone of the church. Not because it is you who will get up here, as I said, on any given Sunday and contribute to the learning of the body, but because your sons might one day. And this task is as essential as any task that could ever be asked of any person. So that I can confidently say that as far as it relates to the person that is most essential to the longevity of Legacy Baptist Church, of its life and of its faithfulness to God, and the longevity of society, it will not be me that will be seen as that one who is most essential to the longevity of the life and faithfulness of this church. It will be our mothers. And to that end, today is a tribute to motherhood. Recognized throughout time as the bedrock of our civilization. And in your faithfulness, mothers, not just the bedrock of our civilization, but the future of it as well. To that end, fathers, to that end, children, honor her as she is faithful in the Lord. Bless her as one who is virtuous. Recognize the fingerprints of her, of your mother, upon your lives. And don't let that go unheeded. Don't let that go underappreciated. Because theirs is a task that, though there is some thanks, such as a day like this, Mother's Day, theirs is a task which is constant. Theirs is a task which takes tremendous patience, foresight, a drive to do something which has very little tangible results in the short term for tremendous long-term gains. And to whatever extent you have seen the benefits of said gains in your life, honor her for that. Give her the honor that is due. And so, mothers, on this day, God bless you for your sacrifice. Know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. Be faithful. Stay faithful, please, because we're all counting on you.
Thank you for listening to Pastor Jamin Wickler from Legacy Baptist Church in Buffalo, Minnesota. More information about Legacy Baptist Church and a library of sermons are available at www.legacybaptistchurch.net.